Excellent. You know, that's relevant because the second half of the show, we've got a chap who's an actor stuntman going to tell us all about his life in Hollywood and things like that. His name's Sean O'Kane, who's going to be... I think I mentioned the Interceptor to you, is that right? Yeah, it was quite a famous sort of programme in the late 80s, I think it was, with Annabelle Croft.
Hi there, this is Billy Kirkwood. You're listening to The Career Show with Eddie Gibb.
Yeah, to somebody out there who maybe recognises that theme tune, that's the theme tune to The Interpreter, that's with the co-starring Sean O'Kane, who's our big interview for the afternoon. And once again, all the Greenwood people are sitting here opposite me and they're all going, "Ooh, what's happening now?" So we'll come back to them in a wee while. But anyway, Sean O'Kane, hello Hollywood, hello Lulu, hello Yvonne, hello everybody up there in Canberra Slang as well. Hopefully you've tuned in as well. This is dedicated to Sean, a brilliant interview. Anybody want to get into acting at all, stuntman, this is the one to listen to. So stay tuned for this.
My name is Sean O'Kane.
Is that your real name, Sean?
No, I was born John Lynch, and the reason why I had to change it was there's another actor from Ireland called John Lynch. He's probably more known for a movie, Sliding Doors. Changed it to O'Kane because my mum's name's O'Kane. And when I called my parents to ask them, Equity or Screen Actors Guild in Hollywood would not allow me to use my real name because there's another actor with that name. So I called my parents right away and said, "I can't use my real name, Dad. You know, if you get any suggestions." And my mum said, "Can you not use my name?" I said, "Well, hold on, Mum." I called them back. "Right, how about O'Kane? Is there any O'Kanes in there?" "No, none." So it became Sean O'Kane. And I like Sean O'Kane's all right. It's my mum's name. She was proud of it. My dad watched his TV and he's like, "Ah, it says starring Sean O'Kane," and my dad's like, "That's no right. That's no right. That should be my name up there." And my mum's like, "No, I cooked him in my oven."
You come from a small family and a wealthy family, is that right?
Absolutely not. No, on the contrary, 12 kids.
Yeah.
And grew up in Camas Lang, actually, the circuit in Camas Lang. If there's any listeners out there from Camas Lang, giving a wee shout for the circuit. Great background for me to develop my skills and my career just by using my imagination.
Yeah.
And what a better place to do it than the circuit in Camas Lang. It certainly had its ups and downs. I mean, more ups than downs.
You've used a lot of these skills during that period to help you.
Well, I've used, that was my training ground. I mean, believe it or not, I mean, I left the circuit when I was 19 and I used the skills that I learned there, and the skills meaning just survival skills, just going out and using my imagination with the other kids in the street, kick the can, building dens, stuff like that, just normal everyday stuff that boys did. Doing dokies, I don't know if you know what dokies are.
No, what's that?
Dokies is jumping from one object to another, and the bigger, the wider the distance, the greater the danger. So hence I developed my skills, my stunt skills.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say using my skills, that's what I used. I just used every day we daft things that we learned as kids. There was no computers, there was no IT world. I think we only had a black and white TV. I never saw a TV till I was about 8. Kids can entertain themselves now without even leaving the house. They can sit in the toilet for 3 days, you know, without getting bored. You know, if I was in the toilet for 3 days, I'd be out the window, I'd be down the drain pipe and up the railway or something like that, you know.
School was, what was that like? I mean, were you an academic?
You know what? I wouldn't say I was an academic, but I did like school to a certain degree. I liked the arts and crafts in it. I liked anything that had to do with developing the skills that became, you know, into entertainment. I used to hide in the art department because I liked drawing, I liked painting. And one of the teachers there, Mr. McCready, he used to let me dog my math class. I was rubbish at math. I hated math. And I excelled in English and I excelled in, like, biology, and geography was one of my favourites as well. School, I mean, St. Bride's is a school that I went to. Don't remember much of it. Just remember playing in the playground, playing football with the boys. And that was it. And then went into Trinity High and left there at 15. Now, I did enough. I wasn't academically inclined, but I did enough to pass my test, my exams. I passed all my exams, but just barely. And I only did enough to pass.
Is that deliberate? You didn't know?
No. I don't think I was conscious of it. I think I just was one of those kids that was determined not to fail. I guess that was you know, in my head at that time. And I look back and I don't really remember anything exciting in school except art. Mm. That was all I remember. And my teacher, Mr. McCready, he was fantastic to me. I mean, allowing me to dog a class. I mean, who does that? I
mean, for that point, you know, obviously when you're saying that everybody says you're going to be a joiner, Sean. Is that right?
That's what I was told I was going to be. My dad's in construction. My dad's a roofer. And said, right, son, your Uncle Jimmy's, you know, my Uncle Jim was a carpenter. And he goes, right, your Uncle Jim said when you leave school, he's going to get you a job. I said, you listen to your dad. I went, all right, you know. So here I leave school, leave Trinity High, right before my 16th birthday. You know, I wasn't too excited about being a joiner because I already had in my head what I wanted to be, but I just didn't share with anyone. So I left school, and lo and behold, the job fell through, and that was me, right on the dole, slapped on the brew. You had to go sign up. Well, that was alien to me. Mm-hmm. I was quite an eager kid with a lot of energy. And that never happened, so I got involved in a YTS program. Mm-hmm. I got involved in that, went to Campbell's Lane College and did a wee stint there for 3 months on building. You know, it was good because it gave me focus, gave me something to do. Although it was as a far cry from what the career, the vocation that I had my heart set on, I couldn't find any of that in the environment that I grew up in. So I excelled in that wee class. You know, I did all right in three months I was there. And then I had an interview with British Steel. Got thrown into that at 16. And then did that till I was 19. And finally I had the courage to take off. It was during the strikes, the British Steel strikes in 1980. That was what made me realise, right, I need to get out of here. I need to go forward and I need to fulfil the dreams that I have. And that was what pushed me over the edge. That was what gave me, you know, the boost to go do it. In 1980, I set off, left British Steel behind it. I think subsequently it closed not long after I left. There were strikes. I was involved in the strikes in the 80s. Mm-hmm. 1980, Clydebridge and Camas Lang, I think. Ravenscraig had it. They were pulling, I think Thatcher was pulling all the work out of Scotland and taking it down south. Mm-hmm. That's what I was taught back then. And I think you were getting paid something like £3 a day mm-hmm. for striking. I don't know about you, but that wouldn't go far.
Before we come to the point where you're going to tell us about your vacation, mm-hmm. you told me a bit about the British Steel. You learned some skills in there. There was union skills, but there was other skills as well. You're quite a kind of a hardy man as well. You looked after yourself and you've got a lot of kind of, what would you say, strong morals. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's just growing up in the environment that I grew up in. You grew up in the circuit. It was a tough wee place. It was a great wee place. I had nothing wrong with the circuit when I grew up there. All the neighbours helped each other out. But there was an element of roughness there whereupon if somebody, you know, accosted you, you retaliated instantly, because if you didn't, you would be beaten up all the time. Mm-hmm. So you learn the skill. When I say learn the skills that I learned back then, that was one of the skills that I learned. I learned how to look after myself. Being one of 12 children, you were taught. I was taught by my dad and my older brothers and sisters to look after your younger siblings. Well, the only way you could look after them was to protect them. Mm-hmm. And it's same in Mother Nature. So I learned how to use my fists back then as a wee boy. And I don't think back then there was anything that much wrong with it, because all the kids did that. Mm-hmm. You all duked it out. So in the British Steel, then I just carried that same principle into the British Steel with me. Dressed up as John Travolta.
I've seen the picture.
I used to dress up as John Travolta. I was a big fan of Grease, as most kids were back then. But it was considered a wee bit.
Yeah.
When I was, you know, you can't be both. You can't be a boxer. You can't be Billy Elliot, you know, in the 70s. You can't be a boxer and a dancer at the same time. I did. I was getting into dancing. It was rock and roll, because it was a wee bit cooler. Then I get into like modern jazz and all that stuff, and started touring the country in Greece. And actually started making money at it back then. I failed to mention that to you. I actually toured Scotland, and there's a comedian called Watt Nicol. I don't know if you know him.
I know that name, yeah.
Watt Nicol, I think he's a motivational speaker now. He took us under his wing, got a bunch of boys together, and he put this band called the Travolta Doubles, and we toured around Scotland. I mean, that is, and limousines and all that. Yeah, we opened up record stores in Glasgow and everything. So I had my first taste of what that excitement was, being a dancer. Well, being a dancer in the 70s in Campbell's Lane, you know, it's a recipe for some unsavoury incidents. Well, some of the lads that were, you know, less than happy about how I dressed would tell me, say, you'll be this and you'll be that. I said, right, well, let's go for a walk and we'll see what I'm. So I duked it out, and needless to say, some of the boys, hopefully they'll listen, apologise if I was a wee bit too rough on you. But you were less than, you know, you were less than favourable to me with your dialogue. So I've got no regrets.
Your dancer got your aim back.
I never went out to seek anybody out. If somebody came at me with, you know, verbal abuse, my first instinct was to retaliate, and that's what I learned growing up. That's what I learned in the circuit. That's what I learned growing up, and I carry that. I still carry it to this day. I don't go around with the same chip on my shoulder, but I certainly carry that primal gene, and it served me well because it protected.
Would you say that was a key factor that says, right, I'm going to the entertainment industry? Was that something that edged you on?
No, that never propelled me on. What propelled me on was my imagination. Mm-hmm. Being a wee boy in a house with 12 children, you have to find some form of release. You have to find some quiet time because you're surrounded with siblings 24/7, whether you like it or not. You sleep together, you eat together, you go to school together. Some of you are in class together. Well, you know, having any child needs a wee alone time. I found my release time, my wee quiet time, was under my bed. And I deliberately put my light out in my bedroom and gone, because I shared my bed with my two other brothers, so there's three of us in that room. So I would go under the bed, put the light, I'd have a flashlight, and I would sit there and study books on Hollywood, mm-hmm. books on movies, encyclopedias, and I would, that was my wee quiet time. Well, I spurred on my imagination by that. I would dream about being on television as a wee boy. You can't share those dreams with people because they think it's so far-fetched, they think you're out of your mind. So looking at these books, it inspired me. Watching movies inspired me. So that's where I got the taste for it. And what it did is it slowly fermented in my body and it fermented in my mind. And when I was in a position to leave, to go seek it, I was ready for it. But what propelled me to get on that aeroplane was just having enough of the strikes, having enough of going nowhere, knocking on the doors in Glasgow and the theatre companies. And because I didn't speak with a gobstopper in my mouth, I can say it now, you know what I mean? These people were less than kind to me, mm-hmm. because I was a wee rough boy from the other side of town, spoke kind of rough as well, and when I asked them, you know, knocked on the door, Mrs. I'm wanting to get into the entertainment industry and that, and can you help me out in that? I said, oh yeah, where do you hail from? Oh, if you're a circuit in Canberra's Lang. Right, well don't call us, we'll call you. Mm-hmm. That's the blow I was dealt. Well, alright, it was a rejection. I thought, alright, no big deal. I go to the next one, knocked on the next door. I went to every theatre in Glasgow. Night, you know, wee boy. They didn't want to know. I mean, I don't know if it's because I had no connections. Maybe I didn't look right. I don't know what the criteria they were looking for. I know now, but I didn't know then. So having all that on my shoulder, that's what propelled me. And those books that I read on Hollywood, I thought, oh, they're magical books. I'm going to jump in a vortex and end up in LA. And that's exactly what I did.
Yeah.
I just took off. I thought, right, I'm getting nowhere here. Getting nowhere. I don't have the right voice. I don't have, you know, the right connections. So what am I going to do? I'm just going to do what, you know, what lives in me. What lives in me is inspiration, motivation. And during all that time I was doing that John Travolta stuff, there was a wee woman in Canberra's Lane called Rena Beattie. And I don't know if she's still around. I know the last time I heard, the last contact I had with her was about 10 years ago in Blackpool. And she's a wee Scottish lassie she's an older lady now, being her 70s. She kept saying, you can do it, son. You can do it. You can go get it. Go get it, wee man. There's nobody stopped me. Go get it. That voice still rings. Still rings in my ears. Still rings in my head. And every time I go do something, I always think of Rena Beattie. So that's why I'm trying to encourage children to follow their dreams. Because hopefully somebody out there will hear those words, maybe my words, but I'm just plagiarising her words. Hopefully somebody else will be inspired by that. And if truth be told, it has come to light that I've done that. I've had that influence on children because of the countless mail that I get. You know, having, saying the right things to children does propel them, does help them. You might not think you're doing it, but you're planting a seed, and that seed hopefully one day will come into fruition and put that child in a place where they can fulfil their dreams.
You're 19, you jump in a plane, a wee Scotsman.
Oh, that's scary.
And you land in LA. I mean, had you any plans? Had you anywhere to go? Did you know what you were going to be doing?
I'll tell you what happened. I'll tell you how I ended up there. I mean, I bought a one-way ticket, Ferry Laker, $99, or £99 it was, one-way, in 1980. Now, I don't know if it was stupidity or ignorance or lack of fear or all three. For a wee boy to come out of Scotland, jump in an aeroplane and go to Los Angeles, it's the other side of the world, and they live totally different from us. I had got my ticket, I had got my visa, my six-month visa, and I had a one-way ticket. I'd saved up my pennies, collecting ginger bottles, collecting scrap, buying and selling antiques in the barras, and I saw in this, I think it was the Sunday Post, there was a fella from Uddingston wishing his mother happy birthday, a big fella called Duke Meekin, and he put his Lock Sun Art Way, I can still remember, this is 30 years ago, I still remember the address, it was Lock Sun Art Way in San Jose in California. So I thought it was San Jose. So I wrote him a letter a week before I was out to fly out there. I didn't know where I was going. I just knew that my desire was taking me that way. I wrote a letter saying, "Dear Duke, I'm just a wee punter for Glasgow and I'm coming to America. I was wondering if I could stop in and see you." And I sent it off to him. I flew out there, landed in Los Angeles, one-way ticket, sent back my family, packed up my toothbrush, and I got to LAX, Los Angeles Airport, and I asked a policeman, "Hey, do you know where San Jose is? Can I get a taxi there?" He said, "That's not San Jose, that's San Jose." So he said, "No, you need to get an airplane. That's 6 hours away from here." I said, "All right." So I jumped. I got another airline ticket. I don't know, maybe $30. Got in an airplane, landed in San Jose, got in a taxi, drove to Lock Sun Art Way, knocked on the door. But before I knocked, I could hear him on the phone, talk to a relative. And he's a big monster of a man, and he used to be a heavyweight boxer. Duke Meekin, he was an older fella. And he's bald as a coot, big muscular guy. He's on the phone, he's drunk out of his skull, he's on the phone. "Aye, Mary, there's a wee boy just sent me a letter for Glasgow. Hold on, there's the door." He opens the door, it's me. "Hello, I sent you a letter. Are you the boy? Come in, son, come in." And that was me taken care of right there. That was the first foray into my mad adventures, because he took me in, and his roommate was leaving that day. I mean, I don't know what you call that, fate, I don't know what you call it, but his roommate was leaving that day, which means there was a spare room. He called up somebody else, and within 2 days I had a job cleaning a pub. I got another job, that was in the morning, I got another job doing sheetrock, you know, the chipboard, doing that, and then I got another job in a restaurant at night cutting fish. So I had 3 jobs within a week. You know, I'm 19 years old. But that was 6 hours away from Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So I thought, right, I'll use this as a wee platform to get my bearings. And then from there, I set out my adventures by subscribing to a stunt school, which was down, you know, I ended up working there for a year. It was a year before I went from San Jose down to Hollywood. So I reached Hollywood at 20.
So you're looking for these links to Hollywood.
Well,
how did you get that?
I didn't know how to do that. I mean, I totally was oblivious to what do they call it when you go to a party and you network,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know much about network, because you didn't network growing up in Scotland. I mean, sorry, you didn't network growing up in Cambuslang. Maybe you did subconsciously or serendipitously, but you never did it, made a conscious effort. I'm going to go meet this guy because he's going to help me out. I don't know anybody like that when I grew up. I go to Hollywood, I didn't know anybody again, got into the stunt school. The advantage that I had, I slept in a van, in a camper van. I bought it, but I couldn't drive it, I didn't know how to drive. So I had to ask somebody, "Can you tell me how you drive a car?" They're looking at me like I had horns in my head. They say, "Well, you put it in gear and you put your clutch." So I taught myself a gear every day. On the Friday, I sat my driving exam and passed it by 1 point. I'd only drove for a week, but I drove this big massive camper van. So I stayed in that. So that gave me independence. I didn't rely on anybody. Had no connections whatsoever. Joined that stunt school. And from there, they set me in the right direction. The chap that ran the school was a chap called Kim Kahana, who's a well-known stuntman out in Hollywood. I don't know now, 30 years ago, he was certainly... He was on Chips at the time. I think he was doubling Eric Estrada. Being in that school, then that got me around the type of people that I wanted to be around. People with the same ideas as me, wants to be in the entertainment industry, wanted to become... I wanted to become an actor who did his own stunts. So what a perfect, what a perfect ground for that to start off with. And then that set me off. That's when I got connections, because I got jobs right away. I actually get jobs right away as an extra. I worked in quite a few films as an extra. And then from there, I met other people, and they put me on to agents and managers. And then that's how it all came about. You know, I just went... My first real job was on Cagney and Lacey.
Mm-hmm. The stunt school, I get asked that quite a lot. Kids at school sometimes. I went because I'm a stuntman.
It's a hard game, man. I'll tell you, I wouldn't recommend it to any kid unless they really wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. Don't have anybody push you into it or somebody tell you you can be a stuntman. No, it has to be you that wants to do it, mm-hmm. because it's a tough, tough game. You have to be mentally and physically fit. You've got to have, your awareness about you at all times. It's not a stupid man's game. It's all the stunts that you do should be calculated to a science. And all stuntmen will tell you that. You don't go in there thinking, oh, I'm a hard man, I can be a stuntman. Not about that. Most of these stunt guys have got degrees. Mm-hmm. Now they do. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, it was probably more nepotistic, where you knew somebody and they got you into it. But it was tough. I did some scary stuff. And I look back now and go, whew, I got lucky.
You jumped for buildings?
Yeah, I jumped off buildings. There's no luck involved. It's all calculated out. It's a science. Mm-hmm. The guy that mentored me is a stuntman, Dar Robinson, who died falling off a motorbike on Lethal Weapon, hit his head on a rock and died. One of the most famous stuntmen in the world. Mm-hmm. And this is him not doing a stunt. He was just driving back to the hotel. Well, he took me under his wing. I met him in a pub and asked him for his autograph. And he told me to meet him at the studio the next day. And he threw a t-shirt. I've still got the t-shirt around the house here. He threw a t-shirt, Don Robinson t-shirt. Still got it. And fantastic guy. And he didn't know me. I was just a wee boy. And took me under his wing. You know, I think he was intrigued by the accent he couldn't understand, because I spoke heavy Glaswegian. Heavy Glaswegian. And that fella was like, every other word, what'd he say? He says, it's all right, you'll figure it out, master. Don't worry about it.
So the stunt reputation built up, and you get into Cagney and Lacey, you're saying?
I got on there. I actually got on Cagney and Lacey again, just by accident. Most of the stuff was by accident. The stunt school was not by accident. Cagney and Lacey was. I had applied to an advert in one of the local drama papers called the Drama Log, and they were looking for... It was non-union, it was no pay, you got the pictures and you got the film, you know, instead of in lieu of payment. There was a chap there, he was asking for two stuntmen to play heavies. So I applied to it and got it. And little did I know, we filmed that wee short film. It was a daft wee short film on the set of Cagney and Lacey. The guy that was directing it was the assistant director in Cagney and Lacey, a guy called Rosenblum. His dad owned Ryan Television. So it just all happened that here, I'm in with the right guy here, but I didn't know that. Yeah. He liked me and said, hey, I want to introduce you to this lady here who happened to be the casting director. And she said, oh, you'd make a great policeman on this show. Because I had a thick moustache, a 19, really thick, big, massive thing. And it helped me play a heavy in this wee short. Well, she gave me a gig on this. She said, well, we're looking for a background cop on this show here. So I said, oh, I'll take it. It's a job. Well, that was the best job I ever had in my life. On Cagney and Lacey for 3 years, 45 shows. And in there, I got to become a stand-in, which I don't know if you know stand-in. You stand in before the actor. It's called Team 2. You get in your Team 2. Stand in front of the light. It gives the director, the light guys, the gaffers, the engineers, it gives them time to set the scene up for light-wise. And the movements and all that. And then it's just so an actor doesn't stand there for half an hour to where this has been done. They sit cosy in their trailers, mm-hmm. eating their caviar and their sushi, which I get to do now. So I did that, stand in, loved it. Didn't mind standing there because I got to stand in for great actors like Brian Denny, he stood in for Lance Henriksen, mm-hmm. Michael Madsen. I got to work with all these fine actors that I didn't know at the time who they were. It's only years later I appreciated it, what I was doing there. But that gave me a platform to where I could branch out, learn more, get into drama school, learn more accents. I didn't know how to speak American back then, or even decent English. You know, oh, God, you know, do that. I mean, for me, it's going to not do that. It was like chewing gum, you know, the wrong way. And it seemed, I couldn't get it at the time. I admitted it. I told Luke in Tyne Daily, God bless her, cotton socks. Tyne used to sit with me every day. She'd be knitting, and she'd be singing old Irish folk songs because her family's Irish. And she was like my grandmother on it. She took me under her wing, told me how to brush up my dialects, my accents, where to go to a train station and listen to people talk and try and emulate their voice. So it was a great school for me because I was getting free tuition from a superstar. I mean, Tyne Daly at that time was getting Emmy Awards on that show, world renowned. And here I'm sitting with her and I'm getting paid to sit with her. And all I had to do was just stand in for a few minutes and play a background cop. So if you watch Cagney and Lacey, you'll see me circulating her desk every 2 minutes. And I'm wearing all black with a shoulder holster with a gun in it and signing my name behind her, Detective Mackenzie. That was the moniker that I took. I made it up myself, that's me.
At that point, you're breaking a barrier down, the ego. You're mixing all these people. Here's a wee Scots guy, 19 years of age, over a course of 3-4 years, all of a sudden, whack, there you are, a top TV programme. Where were you then? What happened to the wee Scotsman?
Oh, he's always been there. I've never lost it. Yeah. The wee Scotsman in my head, I mean, well, he's still there. Mm-hmm. I've just got him trained now. I've got him in a place where I can draw from him if I need. He's not gone anywhere. All I've done is developed skills. And the skills that I've developed was because of me being a product of my environment now. Being in an industry that I dreamed about doing. Following my dream. Being ingratiated into it. Absorbing it and having all these wonderful talented people around me guiding me, steering me, pushing me forward. And you become better at your craft, you sharpen your tools, and your tools is your voice, your mannerisms.
The stunt thing, did that disappear?
No, it didn't disappear because I wanted it to disappear. It sort of dissipated slightly because the producers, when I started becoming more, being more in front of the camera and talking more and becoming more a character and doing acting scenes and doing films as a bona fide actor and not, you know, in the background not saying anything, when that was presented to me and I took it and I was able to do it, the producers don't want you doing stunts. I mean, even to this day they'll tell you they don't want Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt doing these crazy stunts, although they want to do it. So so the onus is upon you to behave yourself, to do what the producers want you to do. And there's a reason, a good reason for them, because the insurance is astronomical on these films. So they've actually pulled me back. They've actually told me, well, I'm doing a programme now, or I'm doing a commercial. Just say I'm in Africa doing a chocolate commercial and I'm on a camel. If you don't see my face, I won't be on that camel. Not if the producers can help it, because they'll save me for the day where they do the close-up and they have me talk. And they'll use a stuntman. He's dispensable, you know, he's a big lighter.
We had that conversation the other day. They were talking about a film set, how many people, when you see the credits in a film, we mentioned
hundreds. Hundreds of them. The plant wrangler, the guy that moves the plant. Hey, we need that plant moved 4 inches to the right. I mean, why don't the director just walk over and move it? He's not allowed to.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, it is probably here in Scotland. I don't know if that's in play here. But certainly out in Hollywood, there's so many unions out there now, you know, for everything. And you can't touch nothing on a set that doesn't belong to you and it's not your department, because basically you're putting that guy out of a job and they don't like it. It's giving somebody a job.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really mind it, because if there's hundreds of millions in a film, spread the wealth.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Give somebody a job. So I don't mind somebody. It's just my instincts drives me to help somebody. You know, me growing up here, the Scottish are notorious for helping people out. You know, oh no, I'll get that for you, pal. I'll get it in. A lot of them are required. Like when you get into the IT industry in the film industry, there's a lot of computer technicians. Well, you do need those, you know, for doing layering and all that and doing stuff with animation. I mean, you look at a movie now, there's probably 250 names on there now.
Mm-hmm. I noticed in your resume, when looking through it, it's not just stuntman acting. There's voiceovers, there's other parts you've been doing as well. I mean, how do you get that? But what happens? I mean, voiceovers basically just a mic and you watch a screen and that's it.
That's it. You, the first, I did a bunch of commercials. I guess that the Americans love Scottish accents. They love it. It's romantic to them. They love Irish accents. They love English accents. They think all English people sound intelligent when they talk. doing the voiceovers, I got an audition. The first one, major one I did, I was still in drama school when I did it, was working with a big director called Philip Noyce. He's an Australian Neanderthal. He's in 6'3" or 6'4". Sorry, Philip, if you're listening. Maybe he's in Scotland filming right now. He had an open audition for Irish accents. They wanted Irish actors for Patriot Games. So my agent called me and said, look, this is up your street, you're good with accents. I said, well, they all kind of thought I was Irish because I had that name, Sean O'Kane. I said, all right, Scottish Irish, they won't know the difference. I went to the audition and he lined everybody up, which is horrendous because when you audition, it's usually one-on-one. You're in there with the casting people and you do your wee bit and you walk outside and the next guy comes in. Well, Philip Noyce is too big and too busy for that. So he lined about maybe 12 guys, lined us all up, gave us all a piece of paper. And on the piece of paper it said, I'm not waiting any longer, which is actually in the movie. That was the line, I'm not waiting any longer. But you had to do it in a Belfast accent. So he gets the first guy and he mumbles out his rendition of, I'm not waiting here any longer. He got to me, I was number 11, there was 12 guys there. And I said, I'm not, and then I swore, waiting here any longer in that Belfast drawl. And he looked, he was lying on a couch, lying out there, you know, and he jumped up. I mean, he came to life and he jumped up and he grabbed my script off me and I looked at it and he goes, hey mate, there's no swearing here. I said, what are you looking for, a terrorist or a ballerina? That was it. I was pretty angry at the fact that he brought 12 actors, you know, 12 fellas in there, and I was all auditioning in front of each other. It's just, I just didn't think it was right. I thought it was unethical. And that was my way of getting back at him. Because at that point, when he did that, I thought, I don't care if I work with this guy. Well, he hired me. The guy next to me, he caught on right away. He did the same thing. And so, yeah, I told the other 10 guys, right, thanks a lot. He says, you two be back here tomorrow at 8 o'clock. Blah, blah. Right, so I ended up working on that movie for 3 weeks with him. And then he hired me after that. I did the same with him as well. Mm-hmm. With Val Kilmer, he ended up giving me a speaking role in that. Mm-hmm. He got me in the camera in that one and let me talk. And that scene in the same that I did with him, there was no dialogue. But of course, Philip knew I was going to talk. He said, right, he said to the camera, the script lady, you might want to follow him right now. And she's like, oh, why? Well, what's going on? I don't know, but I know him and he'll start talking, you know. So, it's, of course, the lady's running after me. I did a big running scene and she's running after me. And Philip says, so she said, well, what's he going to say? And Philip's noise, well, I don't know, just go follow him and see what he says. So I fell down a flight of stairs and, hey, what the bloody hell's going on here? That's the first thing that came into my head. Well, they ended up writing it down and it became part of the film. It's on there for life now. Yeah. You know, sometimes you just have to stick your neck out a wee bit if you believe in something. Mm-hmm. And what that did was it built confidence in me.
You went to a drama school, had an impact on you.
Huge impact. That's what made, that was a turnaround from the violence. That's what shed the violence from me. That's when I didn't need it anymore. That, and also, I did an audition. I'll get back to that question, but I did an audition for a beer commercial, and I did it in a boxing arena. It was in Van Nuys, out in California, and it was called 10 Goose Boxing. They're big people in the boxing industry. When I went to the audition there, it was the same time I joined my drama school. I got the audition, didn't get the audition, but I got an invite from 10 Goose Boxing Association. Now this is, I didn't know this at the time, but it's a big outfit and they're huge and they're on the big arena, they're in Vegas, got all the big fights, or most of the big fights, and I love boxing and I grew up in Camaslang. I went to the Hoover Boxing in Camaslang, so I knew how to hit a bag. Well, I'm in at the audition, I'm giving it hell for leather, and I'm whacking away. Well, here, I didn't get the audition, but I got an invite to become a boxer. The professional body there said, hey, are you interested in joining a boxing club? I mean, coming and training with us, he said. I said, sure, get me in shape. I'm into that. So it was at the same time I was in drama school. I thought, I'll combine the both. I'll use the boxing to get me physically fit, so I'll be mentally fit, and the mental will help me out in the drama. I sustained more punishment in the acting class than I did in the boxing class because of the mental anguish that I went through. And you and I talked about this.
Yeah.
There's exercises that actors do. It's called listen and repeat. It had a fundamental impact on me because it shed all that unnecessary baggage that I had growing up with. It shed it right there in the class. And one of the girls in the class was a lovely actress called Claire Forlani. You'll probably know her from Meet Joe Black in The Rock. She played Sean Connery's daughter. Mm-hmm. Lovely girl, powerful actress, great person to be around. Well, her and I were in the same class, and Talisa Soto from one of the Bond girls. That exercise is what turned my whole life around. Sitting in a chair, looking at the person in front of you, and not having a script, and just saying the first thing that came into your mind, and the other person had to repeat it till it changed direction. Meaning, wherever it went, you had to go with that. And when I say go with it, I mean don't try and mask that you don't want to go there, because you'll be found out. And it's a technique that actors use. And it shed all that violence. Saying it shed it, it means that I didn't need it anymore. When I say shed it, meaning I didn't need it in my life after that. I thought, somebody's looking at the wrong way, I'm fine by that now. I can just shrug my shoulders and smile and walk away. Well, it took a long time for me to get in a position to do that. And this exercise helped a lot. And then from that, they strip you down. It's like peeling an onion. And they strip you down on stage, and they tell you that this is a place to make your mistakes. There's a safety net, and the safety net is the class. It's a structure whereupon everybody can be in the same boat, shed their emotions, get it out there. Americans love to shed their emotions. I can testify, because that class there was more water in that ground than in the River Clyde. And then I got invited back to phase two. You did that, the drama school, for a certain time, and then you get invited back to the advanced course. And at the same time, I'm getting offered boxing bouts, which I declined, because obviously I can't get my face smashed in right before an audition or before I do a film.
You've matured quite a bit at that point. I mean, you've moved on substantially, and you're starting to get more and more roles. Do you see yourself maybe sort of taking on the role, say, you mentioned before, Clint Eastwood, turn director?
Definitely. Down that road, directing. Yeah. I actually see myself directing. Actually, I'd love to. I mean, one of my heroes was, apart from Clint Eastwood, and I got to work with him on Million Dollar Baby, Steve McQueen. Mm-hmm. I just think he's a master. I just love watching him. He's mesmerising on screen. And I think what makes him mesmerising, he doesn't do anything, but he's doing a lot. Mm-hmm. And I like that method of acting. I mean, I don't try and plagiarise what he does. I mean, I do my own thing. I've got my own wee quirks and idiosyncrasies. You've got the talky actors, and you've got actors that don't do much. Clint Eastwood's another one. He's iconic. He's got that low drawl, and but charismatic, incredible man, done great work. And here he's 80, still doing masterful films. He's got one coming out right now with Matt Damon about the afterlife. Now, there's a man in his 80s, Sean Connery. I think he's 80 this year. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, here, I'm half that age. Mm-hmm. That means I've still got a whole lifetime ahead of me. So I'm in no hurry. I'm looking forward to the next 40 years in this industry. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to what's in store for me. When I arrive, wherever I go to, I'll arrive there with a wee bit more clarity, a wee bit more maturity, hopefully.
Do you think you'll be the director that's going to be lying on the couch with 12 guys lined up?
No, I don't think I'd be that rude, Philip. It's just this modus operandi. That's who he is.
Yeah.
I mean, him and I have talked afterwards, and I slagged him about that. And then he told me that he'd been filming all night. So I can understand why he was lying down. He was actually lying down. It looked like he was asleep. He had his arm over his forehead like that. And he told me, and he says, "Mike, I was working all night for about 3 weeks in the dark." And he was tired, so I can understand it. I mean, you don't know the pre-story. When you see somebody doing something or behaving a certain way, you don't know where they came from. That's why I don't judge as easily as I used to do. You know, we all prejudge people. We all look at somebody and go, "Look at that idiot, what's he doing that for?" Well, you don't know where the guy might have just lost his grandmother or something.
To kind of round off something we've discussed, kind of close to my heart and yours, obviously, is a passion to help young people, to try and steer them away for whatever direction they're going in. And I know over the next 10, 20 years, you were saying you've got your plans for the future. Do you see yourself doing something like that, coming back into the community and saying, "Right, I'm going to put something back in and help"?
I would gladly loan my services to help. If I could help one child to go in a direction that I went in. Now, it might not be necessarily the entertainment industry. It might be race car driving. It might be boxing. It might be secretarial work. Whatever medium they choose to chase after. If I could influence one child, then it's worthy, I think. I've got no problem sitting down and talk to kids and tell them what I've done. Well, if it's worth anything to them and it can help them, hey, why not? I think it's quite scandalous not so much even Scotland, all over the world. I don't think they put enough funding into children, and they don't realise that those children are the future caretakers of this very same town they live in, or country, or planet. And there are a lot of good children out there that are just wayward because nobody believes in them. I had a lady, Lena Beattie, drawn back to her. She believed in me and saw something in me and told me. I mean, don't get me wrong, she didn't take me and get me a break. I mean, I did that myself. But at least she gave me the spark. She lit my fire. She was the one that held a flame, an imaginary flame in my mind. So if I could do that with kids, gladly. I mean, maybe you've got a boy who's 17 and he's got a life of violence. I wasn't unfamiliar to that myself. Well, he might become a boxer. Maybe he could take that talent and utilise it in boxing. Maybe he could get in the pugilistic environment and put a pair of gloves on him. He might become a world champion. You don't know. You just have to find what sparks these kids. And I think all children have potential. You know, we all have that. There's opportunities that are out there for us. We just need to find them. And maybe somebody helps you along the way. And then you seize it. You grab it. Carpe diem. And go for it. I don't know if everybody thinks the same way I do. And I don't know if Andy's talking to a hole in my face. But I know I've got an influence on kids. Hence the letters that I get. Every child that's ever written to me, tens of thousands, I've written back to all of them. But I've always made it a point, and the reason why is because I sent fan mail to actors and got no reply back from none of them. And I always swore that if I ever got a wee break on telly and a wee kid wrote to me, because I was one of those kids, I'd write back to them. But they have to provide me with a self-addressed envelope because, I mean, 10,000 letters or more could come quite costly. You know, I don't mind writing back, but here, you know, some people want 8x10 glossies. Yeah. All right, well, download one off the computer, yeah, put it in an envelope, send it. My agent will get it to me, where I'm in the world. It might not get to you for a couple of months because I'll be Africa or somewhere else in the world. But I'll always get, if it's addressed to me and I get it, you guarantee I'll get back to you. And there's a lot of people probably out there in Scotland that have some of these signed pictures. Yeah. That did get a lot of mail back in the day when I was on TV full time.
Great, Sean. Well, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.